Our main speaker tonight is Amy Carey.
I am Amy Kay, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I'll give you my vitals first. I was born in 1968. I got sober in 1983. I was 14. I recently celebrated 15 years of sobriety on Halloween. Now I'll begin with what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. First, I want to thank Tim for making the last 2 months totally nerve-wracking. My stomach's been upset for a long time, and I've been rooting for 9:30 all day long. But this is my truth, okay. It's an honor and a privilege to speak at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this especially, and this is now my home group. And I've only been in the group for a little over a year, and I felt unworthy, as if you wouldn't be interested in anything I had to say. A, because I've not been here long, B, because I got sober at 14, and you know what, it really just doesn't matter. I'm up here to keep myself sober and hopefully help the newcomer. I was born in Hollywood. I was raised in Santa Monica, and and I was born to a mom and dad who were right here in the front row tonight. And this is the first time I've spoke in front of my mother. My father got sober a month after I did, and he's heard me. And I've been nervous to speak in front of my mom, but I got to tell you that seeing her face tonight, I got a warm, safe, comfortable feeling. And I did not like my mom for a lot of years, so this is change for this alcoholic. I didn't like my mother and father growing up, and I'll tell you why. My father was an alcoholic, and when he was under the influence of alcohol, he was violent and rageful and treated my mother badly. And I knew very young that alcohol was doing this. So I resented alcohol and I resented him when he was under the influence. When he was not, he was my pillar of strength. He was the apple of my eye. I was the apple of his eye. I felt that way. He tickled me. He made me laugh. My mother would ground me. He would take me off grounding. She made the rules, and he helped me break them, and it was okay. And he quit drinking in 1972. And when my mother drank, my mother is from Rochester, New York, and she moved here to Santa Monica young. And when she drank, she turned into a British woman. She got an accent that I don't know where it came from. But she would say words like vomit, and I need another beer, and a martini. And I saw that alcohol turned her into somebody that I didn't recognize or know. So pretty much right from the gate, I knew that alcohol transformed people into what I did not want to be. And I promised myself I would never drink. I also promised myself I would never smoke cigarettes because I would smell it on my mother's fingers and my dad's fingers, and it just reeked bad, and I didn't like that smell. And I didn't have any plans for myself, however. I just knew I wasn't going to do these things. I was loved as a kid. I grew up with a sister who's just about 7 years older than me, and she was very into the whole Dogtown scene and surfing and skateboarding and hanging out with all the Alva kids. We lived right next door to them, and it was an image, and she upheld that as best as she could. And I was just young and impressionable and wanted to be around her a lot, and she was pretty emotionally abusive. She would do things like, it used to be that if you dialed your own phone number and hung up, your phone would ring. And she would tell me it was for me, and she would run in the other room, and I would answer the phone, and she would say, "Amy, it's Mickey Mouse, and you're ugly, and I hate you, and you're not allowed in Disneyland anymore." And... And so I didn't feel a lot of love. And I needed a lot of love. And regardless of how much love I got from mom and dad, and you know, it was a lot when they could and when they would, and they did. But I always needed more. And this may have been my alcoholism before I put a drink in my body, and maybe it wasn't. I believe I was born with alcoholism. But I was always looking for love. And I would, like when the movie Grease came out, I would imagine five girls outside my window serenading me, tell me more, tell me more. And I would just go into this whole visual. And I remember being like 9 and 10 years old, listening to 93 KHJ, sad, sad songs. And I'm in so much pain. And there's no man in my life. There's no boy in my life. And I'm heartbroken, you know. For lack thereof, I don't know what it was. But I just always felt a need. And at 6 years old, I smoked pot for the first time. And it was with my big sister. And at 8 years old, I inhaled Pam that you spray in your frying pans. And mom and dad had no idea this was going on. At 11, I had my first drink. And I'd been doing a lot of drugs whenever I could, and I was failing out of school miserably, and I attracted the type of people that I was, and I was starting to ditch school in fourth grade, and at 11 when I had my first drink, I blacked out, and I was a blackout drinker from the gate, and it never stopped, and I would do anything I could to get drunk. And if that meant standing outside of liquor stores, finding older people to buy alcohol for myself and my friends, that's what I would do. And there was a lot of willing people. And at 14 years old, 13 and 14 years old, I didn't necessarily have the body of a 13 or 14 year old. I didn't get carded when I went into bars. And I would put on the makeup and the pumps and all the Aquanet in my hair and the eyeshadow. And I didn't have a hard time at that. And it landed me in the back seats of a lot of cars, not wearing a lot of clothes, not knowing where I was or who I was with. And I never questioned whether or not I had a disease. I thought I was way too young. I did, however, know that now I was putting alcohol in my body, that thing that ruined mom and dad, that thing that turned my examples into less than what I needed, I suppose. But it gave me that feeling of love. And if it didn't give me that feeling of love, it made me not care about that feeling that I was looking for. So I was off and running. And alcohol brought my bottom right up to me. That's what it did for me. And I drank in order to call my boyfriend. I drank before I was coming over. My mom had this cabinet above the pantry with all the bottles of alcohol. And I don't know that she even knows this today, but I would just pour and mix into one big glass and just down it and then make the call to the guy that I thought I loved because he looked like Eddie Van Halen. And he treated me miserably. He was never faithful to me. It was bad. I was put in jail twice behind the use of alcohol. And my friends left me lying in the gutter one night on Ventura Boulevard. I was in a blackout, and I was taken to juvenile hall. And the other time I was picked up by Operation Stay in School, ditching school and passing out the beers to my friends, and I was taken to my jail and my father came to pick me up. And you know, my dad, although he had quit drinking, he continued to smoke pot, and eventually we started smoking pot together. And his words for me were, you know, Amy, you can do whatever you want, just maintain, you know. And I could never maintain, ever. And he picked me up that day, and I'm handcuffed to that bench, and he's doing that, you know, one more time. I've disappointed my dad. And by this point, my mother's relationship with me was not, it just wasn't good. It was a typical teenage relationship between a girl and her mom at 13 and 14, and she would kick me out of the house, and we would say nasty things to one another, and she would have yard sales and sell my things on the weekends. And I remember specifically showing up on a Monday in junior high in eighth grade, and a girlfriend of mine was wearing some of my clothes and thanked me. for a ghetto blaster. And I would move out, and I lived in an abandoned school for a little while, and I lived with some friends, and I got into cocaine, and all the while drinking, all the while blacking out, hearing stories of what I did the next day, ruining parties. I'm the drunk that loves you, and you're my best friend, even though I'm sleeping with your man, you know what I mean? And I was scandalous, and I had no self-esteem. I had not a care in the world when it came to grades. I felt I had nothing to lose and nothing to gain, and it didn't matter. This was my life, and it was all right. I was having fun, I thought. And at 14, I was again living out of the house, and my dad came and he found me, and he sat me down. And he said, "Amy, I'm gonna give you an ultimatum here." He said, "You can either come home and try to make it work with your mom one more time, or you can live with your girlfriends like you're doing now, and party and do all the things you're liking to do, and keep your little job at Winchell's or whatever it was at the time, and if you choose the latter of the two, I'm going to let you go." And like I said, my dad was everything in the world to me, and the alcohol meant more at that point. And I said, "Okay, you can let me go. I'd rather live with my friends." And he said, "Okay, let's go to school, and we're going to get your records and your books, and we're going to get you checked out, and we'll get you on your way." And we did that, and the nurse sat down with us, and he told my dad about Pasadena Drug of Rehabilitation Institution. And immediately my choices changed from those two to this rehabilitation or back to juvenile hall. And I chose the rehab, and I said, "I'm only going to go for 2 weeks, and you have to let me smoke cigarettes," because at this point I'd been smoking, and whatever you want, kid, we got to get you some help. So I went to this rehab, and I was in there for 50 days. I was in there for 2 months, and what they did in there was they got me back eating the right foods, and they got me into something called biofeedback, where you learn to get high naturally. And I thought this was a load of crap, watching a computer shape grow and shrink, and it wasn't doing it for me, but I'd try anything at this point. And they had me in a lot of meetings all day long and talking to counselors and therapists, and I was in pajamas for 3 weeks, and finally I got out of those, and they took me to outside meetings, and Danny T was the first speaker I heard in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and he made me laugh. And that was the first time I had that gut-wrenching laughter that I was raised with, and there was nothing in my body to induce it. It was just real. And one of the other things I had noticed about the people that worked in the hospital was that they were speaking in complete sentences, and I could see the whites of their eyes, and they had an actual interest in what I was saying, and they cared about me. And they started bringing my mom and dad in for family meetings, and I had to tell them some of the things that I'd been through, like molestation and stuff like that. And my mom vomited, and my dad got very angry, and I wrote down a list of all the things I had put in my body. And it was hard. It was difficult. And I had to learn how to build a relationship with these people and how to communicate with them, and it was very difficult. And I was 14, and I knew that I was going to get out of this place and go back into high school. And and I did, and I got out of there, and I was scared to death. I was scared to death to lose what little I had had. And even though I was 14 and didn't, I mean, what do you lose when you're 14? My Barbie townhouse and my skateboard? There's not much to lose when you get sober at 14, but the thing is that I didn't have a chance at gaining anything if I hadn't done it. I believe that. And my parents put me in an outpatient program, and I made some friends in there, and I found out that a couple of them were going to my high school, and I went to that school nurse that recommended that rehab, and I told her I wanted to start a meeting at my school because I was scared for my sobriety, and she said, "Okay, we'll do that," and I organized it, and there was about 8 of us, and we had meetings, and then they broke down because kids talk about stupid stuff, and there's competition and jealousy and all kinds of stuff, so that never worked out, and I started ditching school again. And I never got a sponsor, and I never worked those steps. I would start, and I would do 1, 2, and 3 with my counselor in that outpatient program, but it was not imperative that I do it, as far as she was concerned, the steps, I mean. And so I started ditching school, and I ended up just leaving school, and I thought that it was a perfectly justifiable reason to ditch school because I was going to meetings, and my mom didn't get it, and I didn't get that she didn't get it, and that bad relationship continued, and it was difficult to grow up sober, but I did whatever it took, and I refused to let these people who I called my friends take me down with them, and I found out that I no longer had anything in common with them, and I wanted new things for my life, and even though it wasn't school, it would be sobriety, and that was enough for them, and the longer I stayed sober, I started speaking at high schools and making myself available to do that, and I started speaking on panels, and I started going to a lot of meetings, and 3-4 meetings a day, and I started getting commitments, like secretary commitments and stuff like that, and I had a few sponsors, and I didn't have a lot of luck with them. The first sponsor I had slept with the man that I was seeing. The second one I had got drunk, and the third one asked me to sponsor her. So I thought, okay, this sponsorship stuff is not working for me. I'm just going to rely solely on God. And so I did that for 10 years. And it worked for a little bit. And what I did was I said, all right, God, I would take my flute to the mountains, and I would play my flute to God, and I would write poetry for God, and I gave up eating red meat, and I gave up sex, and I was celibate for over a year, and I did all this stuff for God, and I let go of all of my friends, and my whole world was opening up, and I had this communication line with God that was just unbelievable. I could hear him, and I could talk to him, and I felt safe and in charge and in control. And after that year or so of celibacy, I met a guy, and I said, all right, God, you can relax for a while. I made this man God, and I met him when I was 18, this is what I was. One of my babies, a very good friend of mine also, we were sitting around talking about this doll that we're going to create. And I was this doll. And her name is Codependent Cuddly Carrie. And you pull her string and she says, is my butt too big? Where are you going? Don't you want me to come with you? You're my world. You're everything to me. I love you. And I... this poor guy, I suffocated him. And I didn't get it, that he couldn't love me back. And he would stay sober, and he would get drunk, and he would stay sober, and he would get drunk. And after all of that, I stayed sober, and no matter what, I stayed sober. And I would continue to do whatever I could with what little program I had. And 6 years later, I stopped that madness, and I learned what love was not. And I learned how to love, and I learned how to be faithful. I'd never been faithful in a relationship before. And then I was single for 3 years. Without a sponsor, and relying on God, and it was keeping me resentful, it was keeping me codependent, it was keeping me needy, it was keeping me afraid to tell on myself. I would sit in meetings and hear people quote pages out of the Big Book, and I would nod my head like, yeah, and I had no idea what they were talking about. But I had this number attached to me, this number of years, and I thought that I had to be everything that my ego told me I was supposed to be, and I was scared to death to tell on myself, and I'm really surprised I never drank. God kept a close eye on me. I started reading a number of books, anything but the Big Book, please. You know, it was so boring to me, I just didn't get it. And I would read a lot of Dan Millman and the Tao of Pooh and wonderful books, great stuff. But you know what? It didn't keep me sane. I had no spiritual sobriety. I had no emotional sobriety. I had physical sobriety, and that was it. And I couldn't keep a guy in my life, so I just thought, well, I don't need a man in my life. I need God, and that's it. Screw men, you know. And I tried to change my perception so that I would be comfortable alone. And sometimes I was, but I was kidding myself. And then I met this other guy. See, what was happening is I lived in the valley. Yes, I was geographically undesirable. I was living in the valley, and I was going to Pierce, and I had a little single apartment, the first place I had gotten on my own. I was 10 years sober, and the earthquake happened, and I lost my place, and FEMA gave me a list of cities I could move to, and they said that they would pay a portion of my rent for a year and a half. So I moved to Venice, and I lived at 38 Rose for $64 a month. That was probably one of the best times of my life. But I was scared to leave that house. And I was sober 10 years. And I thought, I didn't get sober for this. And I thought these people were so cool, and they were, I wanted what they had, but I don't know that they even knew what they had and if they were happy with what they had. And it was like there was this big fast-forward mess going on, and I feel like it was, it's as, to me, a man without God is like a teenager in a fast car, you know? And that's what I was surrounded by. And then I meet this guy, and he's nothing like I've ever been attracted to in my life. And he's got all kinds of tattoos, and he's all kinds of muscles, and he's got this look on his face, and he's got a earring out of his eyebrow, and a goatee that he calls a womb broom, and he's got earrings in his ears, and he's got this walk, and he makes me laugh, though, and I'm so interested in him, and I'm the girl that if you make me laugh, I'm naked, you know, I can't help it, and he was so funny, and he had 9 months of sobriety, and I thought, this is it, I'm going to take him home to meet my parents, and my mother's face, hello, and my dad's tight face, you know, that tight smile, and they're always cordial, you know, and she'll always cook a good meal, and but you don't understand, he makes me laugh, and he's sober, you know, and so we decided 4 months after knowing one another that we would get engaged, and a year later we got married, and 2 weeks after the honeymoon we found out we were pregnant. So 94 we met, 95 we were married, 96 I had a baby, 97 I had another baby. Tired. But what was happening is this relationship, when I got pregnant, it started to go downhill, this marriage that I had. And I would not have wanted to be, I would not have been married to myself if I were this guy. When I was pregnant, I was horrible. I was hormonally challenged in every way. And I accused him of being white trash because we had no Italian dressing in the refrigerator. And I would cry over the stupidest stuff, and everything made me vomit, and I was a mess. And he told me, after we had that baby, she was 3 months old, he said, we have got to get a program. You have got to get a sponsor. I've got to work a program, and we've got to start over, and if we don't, we're going to get a divorce. And so we separated for 3 months, and he found the Pacific Group, and I found a sponsor that was a sponsor by name. And he started getting very active in this group. And like I said, I got pregnant again right after that. And I was home on the couch pregnant and with a little girl. And he was, I'm going to a meeting. I got a commitment. I got to go to the yard. I got to go to a watch. What are these things? And why aren't you home with me? You know, I was very angry. I was very jealous. I thought every woman in this room wanted my husband. I had no self-esteem, no security. I couldn't stand being ripe and full and pregnant and fat when I was just a little tiny thing prior to that. And my happiness was based on what I looked like and what he looked like. And you know what you guys did to him? You turned that muscle, ego, crazy hard guy into this man that bought a minivan who wears long sleeves, took the earrings out, and he's 100% Alcoholics Anonymous. He was my Eskimo. And I wanted what he had, and I had to tell on myself to get it. And when his sponsor, Don Newcomb, got in an accident, I went to the hospital to see Don, and I met Karen Garrison there. And I just watched her, and I listened to her, and I saw that she was watching the boys while Don was in the hospital, and Mary Lisa was by his side, and I admired her, and I thought she was... there was no bull about this woman, and I respected that. And Charles and I were arguing still, and he said, "You got to do something, man. It's not going to work." And I just called her up, and I said, "I'm having a hard time. I don't know what to do. I'm having problems at home and my husband." And she said, "Do you want me to sponsor you or what?" And I said, "Yes, yes." And she said, "Okay, you got to get on your knees every morning and every night. I want you to read 2 pages of the Big Book a day. I want you to go to 4 meetings and get 2 commitments. I know you got 2 babies at home. That's the best you can do right now. Do it." I said, "Okay, anything." And I was willing to go to any lengths. And it's just been over a year, and I'm still doing all that stuff and more. And I'm sponsoring 8 beautiful women that go to any lengths today. And you know what? I don't debate with my sponsor. I don't question a damn thing that she says to me over the phone. I just do it, and I'm happy. I'm happy. Charles and I are still together, and he's still my pillar of strength. He's still my example, and I learn from him, and I get to be an example to him, and I get to have this 15 years of sobriety and dedicate it to God, to my sponsor, to my mother and father, to my 2 beautiful children, to the girls I sponsor. It has nothing to do with me. I thought this was a selfish program. It's a selfless program, and if you're new in the room tonight, I want to tell you this. That I read something and it just really hit home for me, and it made me think of when I was new, and it makes me think of whenever I go through something difficult in my life, I think of this, and it is that if you come to the edge of all of the light that you have inside and you have to take a step into the darkness of the unknown, believe that one of 2 things will happen to you. Either there will be something solid for you to stand on, or you'll be taught how to fly. And that's what it is here. And either way, you're safe. Either way, you're safe. And since I've come to the Pacific Group, I did a lot of clubhouse sobriety. I did a lot of Ohio Street on Saturday night, Second and Hill on Wednesday night, you know. A lot of the Valley Club, and I'm not knocking any of it. I stayed sober for a long time doing that stuff. You have restored my faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the traditions here. I was raised with traditions, you know. My mother's house at Christmas is like Mrs. Claus, you know. Sitting down, having a meal with my family, that's what I grew up with. That's what this place reminds me of. You've taught me to be who I am when I'm in prayer. Always, whether I'm in this meeting or at the market or home with my husband. You're teaching me how to practice my principles in all my affairs. And I started working the steps again with Karen, and I'm 3/4 of the way through my 9th step, and I didn't have a lot of fear in my body today, knowing I was going to get up here. And like I said, when I saw my mother's face, I felt safe and warm, and I resented her, like I said. And now I have a love for her that has come through staying sober, through becoming a mother, and just a whole change of perception. I love my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to give this away. I love to see people get it and be enthusiastic about it. There's nothing better. I think that there's so many people in this world who may even not have a disease, but could use the 12 steps. Seriously. It has changed my life. And at 14 years of sobriety, when I started over, it was a surrender, truly, and I wasn't scared anymore, and I knew that everything was going to be okay, and I have a sponsor that I trust and that I love, and I know that she loves me, and I try to be that for other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just try to be my link in the chain, like my husband says, you know. And another thing that he taught me that is so true is that whether you have time or you don't, you don't have to get drunk to start working the steps. You can start over any time. And I had a lot of amends to do because I'd had 14 years of, or gosh, 28 years of life. And it's just freedom. There's nothing scary about it. So stay. Stay. It's right, and it's good, and it's God. And God's not scary. You know, he's always been my right-hand man. I'll tell you this. This is my short story about God. not long ago, my husband and I were having problems. And our marriage was threatened again, and I didn't know what to do. I was very, very scared. Not even so much for myself, but for these babies, you know, and that whole family unit thing. And I had people from all directions coming to me with advice. My sponsor, my friends, the girls I sponsor, everybody telling me what they thought was best, my mom and dad, my sister. And it was like madness in my head. And I'm feeding my son, Jake, who at the time was, I don't know, eight months old. And he had food all over his face, and he was a mess. And I just started praying for an answer. God, what do I do? What do I do? This is crazy. I don't know what to do. And he said, Amy, feed Jake. Just feed Jake. So I just do what's right in front of me. I love this place. I cannot get enough of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess that's all I got. Thanks.